exciting.
Welcome to PDGA Radio this spring break week of 2022. I'm Grant Zellner along with Jennifer Allen. And I say spring break because that's what it is in my neck of the woods. But I know all across this great nation and even around the world, there are all kinds of different times when people mark the beginning of spring, the beginning in the U.S., at least for daylight saving, which means, if anything, it means more disc golf. Hi, Jen.
How are you? Our spring break is actually this week. We ran over to San Diego for a few days and took in a little bit more sunshine.
Yes, recording this a couple of days in advance because we had the opportunity to get a very special guest on the PDGA Radio podcast. Joining us right now from his home in California, none other than Dan Stork Roddick, PDGA number 3. That's right. You only need one hand to show Stork's PDGA number. And we are just thrilled to have a living legend here with us today. Stork, how is the weather out there in lovely California?
It is the reason that I moved here. because I realized life is short. And as wonderful as New Jersey was, we basically had to hibernate for a good bit of the year. And if you watched first round of Waco, you got a little bit of a hint of what trying to play in Jersey is. And so when I got out here and was rolling around in the Bermuda grass for a couple of WFCs, I said, this should not end.
And I agree completely.
And it hasn't. There, Jen, you are in Arizona now, having moved from my neck of the woods in Oklahoma. We're dealing with the same weather system they have in Waco, only we have snow on the ground. No, nothing to worry about, though. It's going to be 65 degrees in less than 48 hours. So that's the world we live in. But Stork, we wanted to have you on because who wouldn't want to have you on their podcast? And you've been so generous with your time speaking to all kinds of different podcasts over the years. What's unique in our situation right now is that, as you well know, PDGA membership has skyrocketed over the last 18 to 24 months. And I was just working with the demographics earlier today for a future article. We have so many new members to the PDGA, so many people who have just been introduced to our great sport in the last year or so. And because of that, I have a sneaking suspicion that a tremendous percentage of those listening right now don't know who you are. They may have heard of you. They may have heard us reference you before, but they don't know who you are. They don't know what it means to be PDGA number 3. So if you wouldn't mind indulging us and allowing us to sort of introduce you to a brand new audience and tell us a little bit about why your nickname is Stork. Maybe we should start right there.
Wow. That's actually a pretty epic story. I wish it was shorter.
We've got time.
It's based in Ultimate.
Mm-hmm.
I was fortunate enough to play in the first intercollegiate Ultimate game between Rutgers and Princeton.
Wow.
I was with the good guys, Rutgers.
What year was this?
72-ish.
Okay.
Or correct me, early, yeah, 72. I'm terrible on dates. Everything was 1972.
Okay.
my second year of grad school. So go Google it. I don't know.
All right.
I had just been introduced to Ultimate, although I had played tons of Frisbee football and through undergrad and high school and elementary and that kind of thing. But then I got introduced to Irv Kalb and to Rutgers Ultimate, and up comes this first game between Rutgers and Princeton, 103 years to the day from when the first game was between Rutgers and Princeton in football.
Wow.
On the same piece of ground. Oh. And so it's all lining up. And Irv and Jeff West and some of the other movers and shakers had really promoted this. They had I mean, Jim Boughton was out to cover it. And so this game starts and it's on asphalt. Oh. And so there wasn't a lot of diving. And so there were a lot of floaters. And, you know, I'm 2 meters tall. That's another story. And so I was catching a lot of goals. Irv was throwing them, and Jeff and Stu Case, and we had a lot of great throwers. I'm catching a lot of goals. So they pull me out. That's fine. I get a breather. And as I'm on the sidelines now, the crowd is growing. It's the pitch is surrounded by students. And every time there's a pull, they're going, whoa. And so that sound is going all the way around campus, and it's getting thicker and thicker and thicker. This is unbelievable. It's huge. And so I'm on the sidelines, and we start to hear this chant, Stork, 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 Stork. It means nothing to me.
Right.
I mean, I went through high school basketball and tennis and all this, and never, Stork, never heard that. And so they put me back in, and yay, the Stork is back. You know, I'm going, moi? I mean, and so it caught on that day. It was big. We win by 2 over Princeton, just like we did in football. It's everywhere. It's every TV station. It's full page in the New Jersey papers. It's featured in the New York Times. I mean, forget Babe Ruth.
Wow.
Forget Babe Ruth. Here's the Stork. And I'm going, this is unbelievable. I mean, it's in Sports Illustrated, faces in the crowd, you know, Stork, blah, 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 blah. And so, wow. Okay. Irv and I go on. We return to kind of real life. The next game has 12 parents watching, you know, and so we are successful that coming year. We're a freestyle team. We win the Canada, the U.S. and the world freestyle title. We're doing the at the Spectrum, we're doing the Sixers halftime. And so we do the halftime. It's great. We come off, we're under the stands, and the head marketing guy says, wow, that was great, guys. Great. I'm from Rutgers. Oh, fantastic. And he says, Stork, do you know how you got your nickname?
Oh, wow.
And I said, well, yeah, I mean, the first game, right? No, he says, do you know how you actually got it? I said, well, I think so, but enlighten me. He says, well, I was in Sigma Pi fraternity, and our fraternity house was hard by the parking lot where you guys were playing. And we were up on the balcony watching, and I'm there with the brothers, and we're watching you. And I say to the brothers, hey, man, that dude really looks like a stork. Let's start a chant.
Wow.
And so we start a chant, Stork, 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 Stork. I mean, did you see the banner that was hanging over there in the frat house that says "The hell with McGovern, Stork for president"? That was my bed sheet that I named you. And I'm just going, okay, then. Wow. That's a legit nickname. I will keep it. And I'm very stork-like, as you may have seen. So that's the epic story of my nickname.
And little did he or you at the time know the legs that nickname would have, not only continuing in the world of Frisbee and freestyle and ultimate, but, you know, these are the days, I guess you could call it BDC, the days before disc golf, at least in terms of it being organized. Mm-hmm. This is still, this predates that by what, about 4 years, give or take?
Probably not four. Because 74 is first octet, and then the car at AFDO. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of my introduction to big time golf, because we had golf at the octet, the eight event octet. Mm-hmm. And Jim Palmieri and the Rochester Club came down and they said, hey, later this summer, we're going to have a big tournament. We're going to give away a car.
That's right.
And everybody said, wow, that sounds cool. Let's go up and do that. And so then that summer where, you know, Victor Malafrati and Kirkland and John Conley and Bruce Koger and all of the players came for this car. That was the beginning of golf to me.
I see. So, okay.
you know.
And then it was about 2 years after that is what I was, I guess, thinking is when Steady sent out those first 100 letters soliciting people to join the fledgling at the time PDGA. I believe that was 76.
Yeah, probably 70, because 76, he calls me and says, hey, I know you're finishing up there at Rutgers, but would you like to come out here and be the director of the International Frisbee Association?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, wow, this sounds like trouble. Because the most common end of a post-grad degree is ABD, all but dissertation.
Right.
People drop out, they get married, they get pregnant, they get a job, they get whatever, and they're done. And here was my off-ramp to it. I mean, how can I say no to that Bermuda grass and and come out and do this? And so I said to my reluctant wife at the time, I said, but I could always come back. I mean, this might not be permanent, but I can't be looking over my shoulder the rest of my life and wondering what that was like, you know, just because I'm head of the social department at Susquehanna.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've got a chance to get the gold ring here. I got to do this. So we did.
So at that time, and I realized that I'm jumping over some really cool Frisbee related history, but at that was near the time when you officially acquired the infamous number three.
Well, a number of things happened, including once Ed brought me out to do this, it wasn't too long after that he had his disagreements with ownership at WAMO and said, well, I'm just going to quit if it doesn't go my way. And they said, see ya. And so I'm there, the new guy. And I basically said to Ed, Hey buddy, I'm not going to stay and undercut you. If they think that they can keep all their Frisbee knowledge just by keeping me cheaper than you, I'll go back to grad school. I got to finish up anyway. And he said, now you're already out here and you like guacamole. Why don't you stay? And he probably regretted it years later when, you know, we frequently had disagreements. But I stayed, and it was crazy, crazy time, because of course the fact of the matter is I had then unlimited latitude when he left, because now, I mean, I was the man, and so it's regional directors and World Frisbee Championship and rules committees and bang, 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 Frisbee World Magazine, just building everything out as fast as we possibly could. Joe Cahow was my assistant, and I quickly got a staff of 4, 6, 8. I mean, it was dream time. And I'm going, go back to Rutgers and do a dissertation? That wasn't till later. My mother shamed me into that.
Moms can do that.
Yeah. Yeah, it was the same way with Boy Scouts. She went and said, now look, you're the tallest boy there. I'm not coming to any more meetings until you get Eagle.
Oh, wow.
I actually helped one of our local Boy Scout groups got their Eagle patch by putting in a disc golf course in Oklahoma.
Oh, nice. Mm-hmm. Nice.
Down in Tuttle.
Cool.
So how did disc golf come into your wild and varied story, Dan?
Well, the Octed had 8 events, and one of them obviously was going to be golf.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had a course there. It was one of the 8 events. And that, I've told this story many times, but love it or hate it, that was the beginning of the 2-meter rule. Because we were basically laying out, well, how are we going to play here? How's the lie going to be, et cetera? And I'm walking the group through the course and saying, now, if you get stuck up here, you know, above ground, if you can put your foot up on the lie and play on, then you're good. And if you can't, then it's a stroke. And Paul Mary's about, I don't know, 4'8", 4'10", something like that. And he's going, that's not fair. That's not fair. You're so tall. You know, I said, okay, wait. Okay, you're right. We'll make it a fixed height. I'm 2 meters tall. I'll always be there to measure it. So make it 2 meters. Arbitrary, he says, okay, that's fair. So it was 2 meters after that.
And there it is.
And so we played that in that event, the eight event octet, but the eye was on the end of the summer with Jim and the AFDO, the American Flying Disc Open, in the car. And so I started preparing for that probably as carefully as I ever prepared for anything. And I got myself a white 122 gram CPI Concept Products disc, the first of the discs with no upper ridges, and just grooved that thing. And I played the whole tournament with one 121 gram disc. And so we go up there. I had low expectations in terms of competitive success. Connie and I had bought a brand new Mustang the week before the event. That shows my level of confidence. So we drive up and we're kind of crowded, and my buddy Gary Subert says, "Don't worry, Stork, there'll be plenty of room on the way back." I'm going, "Yeah, right. Okay." And we go up there, and I guess the most amazing thing in my competitive life was when I look at the board after the first round and there's my name 17 throws ahead of Malafronte and the rest of the field. And I'm going,
whoa,
what? How the hell can that be? Because, I mean, I just, Victor and John and Kirkland and Connolly and all those guys, they're better athletes, just flat out better athletes. They were more experienced. I just assumed I'd be a middle of the pack guy, but I had a good bit of let's call it ball, of ball experience with my dad. So my course management skills probably were better than theirs. Victor's in particular. Victor's throwing behind the back trick throws and everything in golf. And I also had this long range vertical putt, because remember, we're putting into a low box that Palmieri has that's maybe 4 inches high and a foot and a half on each side. So, you know, other guys are trying to throw a floating bounce in there. It's like trying to land a jet plane on a coffee table. You know, I mean, it's very hard. I'm throwing a high, what would you call it now? It's like a super hyzer, just a cut throw that's landing right on its edge. It's either going in or it's staying right there. And then if I was any short distance away, I was just falling as far as I could, putting my lanky frame out and dunking it. So that's the source of the no falling putt. Cause I come back to Palmieri at the end of the round and I look like a rugby player. I'm covered with grass and dirt and mud. I said, "Jim, we're not going to do this for the rest of our lives. We can't have it that people are going to be doing that." So I think it ended up probably 11 or 12 throws at the end, but I'm going, this is unbelievable. It was, you know, a dream. I'm not even a dream. It was more than a dream. It was a fantasy. I'd never dreamed it. And Subert saying, "See, I told you there'd be plenty of room on the way back."
So a few years later, you become one of the first members of the PDGA.
After Ed left, we drove, it all links together. We drove the brand new Datsun B210, sold the brand new Mustang. I couldn't break Palmieri's heart. Kept the B210, drove it out to take the job that Ed had offered me. And then he precipitously leaves and tries to decide what he's going to do. And here's where Ed's genius showed, because as I said, a few years ago, I got Ed Hedrick Award up at Northern California. They were nice enough to give me that. And I said, when Ed left WAMO, it was to modernize it. It was like leaving the creative director of Google job. He had the catbird seat, the best imaginable job. He leaves that job and now, what's he going to do? He had many options. He had lots of clever ideas about oil collection and lots of patents. And of all those things, he decides that he wants to promote disc golf, which in the beginning, he didn't really, I mean, he was a guts guy. I mean, disc golf, he didn't know really if that was going to work. Palmieri tried to talk him into it. I don't know, whatever. George Sappenfield tried, oh, whatever. But then he saw the light. And so when he leaves, he decides he's going to chuck everything and put everything on the line to develop disc golf. And now we look back and go, yeah, whatever, you know. But no, when you think about it, at that time, there wasn't a single permanent course on the planet. Mm-hmm. Not a single permanent course on the planet. We knew everybody who played. We knew every single person who played. And he decides he's going to go all in on that. I said, it's like saying, okay, I got this great idea. I'm going to attach food to email. What do you think? And you say, that's a fantastic idea. But really? And so there's where Ed's genius was. I mean, to say, to have the vision to say, yes, this is going to happen. And then he starts the PDGA, which was confusingly both his company and this organization. And he gifts me with, hey, this is going to be great. Here's your number. You know, and I'm going, three, huh? So you didn't think of me until after Victor? Okay, fair enough. But he gives out 10 numbers. Then he remembers Kenny, his son. He has to give Kenny minus one. Kenny is minus one because Ed, he got already used to double digits by the time. Oh, Kenny, damn, right. Okay. How about minus one? Okay. So anyway, three. He blessed me. He really did bless me. And the funny thing now is, and again, something I said at that acceptance, now, I mean, white beard, tall, whatever. I'll be at a disc golf event and some young kid will come up and go, hey, steady Ed, right? Oh, one, aww, you know, and I go, well, I don't want to disappoint him. So I go ahead and sign the disc. So there's a good many steady Ed 001s out there that maybe not steady Ed. But
do you sign it steady Ed or do you sign it Dan Roddick?
Just 001. you got here a little late, but yeah.
001. What a great story. What was your involvement there through those earliest, I don't know, I got to pick a date range here. So maybe that first decade or so, you know, through the 70s into the 80s, you know, what kinds of things were you doing in the sport?
Oh, do you pronounce it Halcyon? Is that how it's pronounced? Halcyon? Mm-hmm.
I think
really
so.
Really good times.
Is that it? We'll go is with that. It? Really good times, hey, with Google. Hyphens. That's good.
Hey, Google, how do you pronounce Halcyon?
On the website dictionary.com, they say Halcyon.
Okay.
Adjective also Halcyonian. Halcyonauhn. Halcyonian.
Okay, okay. Stop. Google, stop. Yeah, Halcyon. Close enough. Really, really great days they were. I mean, this is World Frisbee Championships in the Rose Bowl, the first of the disc golf championships there. Tom Kennedy comes out of nowhere to Oak Grove and beats all these super experienced people. This just beach bum guy comes from nowhere and wins that. Because Ed had the first world championships were a kind of a skill contest, throw curves and skips and everything into circles. But the mentality I brought still was the octad one, which essentially was from my experience with my dad's track and field background. And I'm saying multiple events, different disciplines. And so we started to build it out that now you're going to throw distance and accuracy and golf and freestyle and these various things. And they're going to all be added together for the overall championship. And people bought into it. I mean, they really liked it. So we were doing those. And then to qualify for the world championships were the national series events that were all over North America. And that's when just things blew up. I mean, we were putting it in Frisbee World magazine. And so, oh, wait, I have one here. People were essentially, when you talk to folks from that era, that was their lives, was touring. You first of all, try to find a used VW van and some friends, and then get in it and go wherever the series points are. And so people would travel, and you had to earn those points in order to get the invitations to the Rose Bowl. And then you end up here, and Whammo's paying everything. Get on the plane, it's all paid, and prize money and endorsement deals. And so developing all those events. So we're going to add DDC now. We're going to add Discathon. We're going to add all these things to build out for different skill sets. And that went up to 82. And then in 82, we shifted gears and went away from WFCs and went to US Opens, which we held at La Mirada. And those were 400 player events, 10-day events, 15,000 people in the crowd. It was crazy time. I mean, it was just a great time to be alive. And we were living the dream, really. So I was busy.
And then from there into, say, the early 90s, just a continuation of that? Or did things begin to sort of hone in on certain initiatives as the sport grew?
Well, at a certain point when, well, Frisbee ownership went through from Whammo to Kransko, a Northern California company, and then to Mattel, that morphed into Mattel Sports. But as that shifted, like kind of the last 2 years of the bigger time promotions at Whammo, we had brought on our cousin Hacky Sack. And so that was a series of Hacky Sack and Frisbee festivals that were fairly big all across the country. Big MTV buys. Think of them as Smithsonian. An amazing number of players got their first introduction to the sport at these because they were broadly publicized. And Frisbee was really riding the back of the Hacky Sack money because, man, let's just say it's a good business model to make a 50-cent bag of sand and sell it for $9. That, I don't know if you know much about margin.
That's pretty good.
But that's a hell of a margin. Yeah.
It also sounds like Haley King was born a couple of decades too late.
Hey, I'm so delighted to see her kicking out there because everybody used to kick at Frisbee events. Everybody kicked. So anyway, So then there was essentially a gear shift where it just ran out of steam on the Frisbee side. Other companies were coming on, in particular, Innova and Discraft, and they had realized the importance of specialization and developing products specifically for disc golf that really was outside of Whammo's wheelhouse. Mm-hmm. You know, of where you're going to weigh every disc? I don't get it. I mean, like somebody actually handles each disc and weighs it. I mean, it's just was beyond them, really. And so it came to the gear shift by the time I was at Mattel Sports of where we essentially became a sponsor of play. We focused mainly on juniors because that was really our big deal. There was a point where we were delivering juniors packages to 2,000 schools in the country and then having them qualify for regionals and come to finals, which were at Disneyland, Disney World, Six Flags at various places, Marineland, et cetera, where a lot of people who we know now cut their chops there, Stevie Rico and Chauncey Donaldson and lots of people who came and played in that juniors. It was a fantastic event, and that's where we were focusing, whereas we were interacting with PDGA and UPA, FPA, GPA. Sounds like government.
Sounds like alphabet soup.
We were supporting each one of those as an outside sponsor. And by then, we had slipped away from it's just a Frisbee brand sport to it's an open sport, and many different discs are being used in it. So that was a tough but important transition.
Huh. Wow. So it's, I don't think I've smiled this much and just nodded my head as much in a single podcast we've done so far. So much history and so much. That's really, really fun. And I think I've managed to bring you fairly close to the point at which Jennifer and I were more or less introduced to the sport. Ooh. Sort of for me, very late 90s. Jennifer, for you, about the same time. Jennifer and I are about the same age. And we both came to the sport via our own paths. But I think we've maybe...
These socks are older than that. Okay.
Okay.
I've been wearing these socks to play Frisbee longer than that. Just saying.
So Grant and I came on before 2000. Our numbers are below 16,000. So we have from... Oh,
wow. Yours is below 16,000. Mine is 61914.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So
yeah,
from 74, number three, to 2000, we're up to like 16,000 members.
Right.
And then it just starts snowballing. How amazing was that for you to see?
It's like a joke. At the PDGA board, because I'm a kind of a professional wet blanket, if you will, that, you know, like whoever is the executive director, like when BG Graham was the director and now Joe, and, you know, they would come in with these glowing growth reports. And at the end of that and everything, and people are going, you know, where's this going to end up? And I would always say, folks, I want to tell you, this can't continue. Okay, this growth that you're looking at, it can't continue. And I have a little story to share with you. I know you're all feeling high on this growth right now, but let me tell you, the Titanic was making excellent progress. Okay, that they thought it's a clear night, and what the was that?
Oh, you know,
I'm always the guy saying, hey, let's be reasonable about this. Yes, that chart is going up like this, but rainy days could be ahead. Let's be careful. So I'm always that guy.
When did you begin to change that tune?
Never.
Oh, never.
I was going to say, clearly he's still thinking that. Maybe this COVID virus was the reverse Titanic for us. So instead of causing harm, you know, to the boat, now we are just growing and growing even more. It was a gift.
I'll tell you. I have the great, wonderful gift in my life of having my feet, many feet. They should call me the arachnid, right? And the storm. I have feet in all of the disc sports, deep in ultimate, freestyle, etc. And I didn't really foresee the critical difference between the various games, because this was a terrible thing for Ultimate. I mean, it was just, they were forced to
shut down,
essentially shut down completely. And I mean, I'm not proud of it, because I'm supposed to be a future seer. That's what my job is, to see ahead. And so, I mean, I think I knew clearly enough that this was going to be trouble for competitive Twister. Okay. Like I knew that, but I just didn't realize, because remember, you got to turn the dial back a little bit. Remember that there was a period of time when we were so concerned about contact contamination.
Right.
We were talking about, are we going to need containers of cleanser at every target, because what if somebody else's disc hits the chains and then yours hits the chains and their little germs touch your little germs? And, you know, so we were still very tentative about this, but as we began to learn that outdoors is your friend in almost every circumstance, that it, and I think we just collectively realized that, and people were so needing this kind of experience. I don't know if you caught my article a while back of, I guess two issues ago, where I was talking about essentially my pandemic experience of it just completely revitalized my interest in play, where I was just a crazy man. I mean, I was out doing field work every single night. I mean, Janet couldn't believe it. But it was my salvation, really, because mm-hmm. what's the alternative? I mean,
right.
watch another Jeopardy, you know. and so fortunately, and incidentally, my wife and I, we watch Jeopardy. This tells you how old we are. We watch Jeopardy every lunchtime. We sit down, we have lunch together, we watch Jeopardy. You know, it's really kind of cute. Same segment. We watch the same segment each time, and we're getting better at it. We got almost all of the answers today.
Pretty good. I definitely sprayed down plenty of baskets in that little period with bleach. And you definitely were like, what are we doing? There was more. That was a mess. But hopefully we didn't ruin too many baskets out there. Here in Arizona, right when the start of that COVID period, we were just getting our first women's professional ultimate team, the Arizona Ooh. Sidewinders.
Oh, nice.
And so I unfortunately got to see how that kind of shut them down and they missed their entire first season. But I'm very excited to say we are going to a game and a clinic. My boys will be learning a little bit more about Ultimate this weekend. Nice. So they are getting back out there and all these teams are starting to compete again. And it's an incredible sport as well.
Oh, man. Well, I'm a huge fan. We have the Aviators out here are our pro team, and we are season ticket holders every year, and really looking forward to great season. It's well, you can imagine we were in that first game, just the two teams,
yeah.
And so extrapolating on now, pretty much every college in the world mm-hmm. has a team, and now pro, and so all of this stuff really is kind of mind blowing. To me, that all of this has happened in such a dreamlike way.
So Ultimate has a little bit more portion of your heart than disc golf?
You know, one of the things that I really love about this set of games is that, what was the song, Love the One You're With?
Yes.
You know, I mean... Mm-hmm. When I'm sitting in the stands with the Aviators, then yeah, absolutely. When I'm, as I was this morning, playing with my buddy at Whittier Narrows, there's not another thing in the world other than this approach shot. And so I really think that disc sports is probably the best investment in terms of recreational competitive play that a person can make, in that there's so many ways that it can apply to your life. So you go to college, you're hot to trot, you're playing competitive ultimate, you leave there and you go somewhere else and they have great golf and you already have the beginning of a skill set that you need, you play golf, they transfer you to San Diego, oh, too bad. Here's this great freestyle group. You can already throw and catch. You get in with them. They say, oh, we play DDC on Saturdays. You go and you discover that. As opposed to you go to Johns Hopkins on a lacrosse scholarship. And that's great. And then you go to the senior banquet and go, what next?
Yeah, I'm done.
You're done. You spend the rest of your life saying how great you were in college. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's a fantastic gift. There's no other sport that has the carryover flexibility that this does.
Right.
I mean, it's so the answer is yes. It's my first love.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimate.
I always love teaching the kids in the schools, because once they see the Frisbee fly, they'll listen to anything you say. It's just I'm automatically out of their mouth. Just, whoa. I mean, they've seen a baseball fly. They've seen a football fly, but nothing flies as far as a Frisbee. And so it just shocks the kids. And I think that's the part that kind of hooks us all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just get to watch this thing fly through the air and you did it. So I think that's just part of the the love and the attraction to keep playing.
It's like an epic paper airplane every single time.
You know, that's well said, because it really is more than how far it flies. It's the nature of the flight, because it defies mm-hmm. gravity, mm-hmm. because those kids are used to the pull of gravity working on a ball or anything else that is thrown. One of the most extraordinary experiences I ever had, which is a hell of a lot to say, is Joe Cahow and I did in mid-70s, the first tour of Outsiders doing Australia. And so we got to throw in front of a number of groups, one of them Aboriginal, essentially, who had never seen a disc fly. Mm-hmm. Well, then all of their expectations were, whoa, like, and they're looking at it and, well, it must have some little motor in it or something. And that's how Fred Morrison, when he and his wife sold the first discs at the LA County Fair, they sold you the invisible string that the disc flew on, because people couldn't believe that it just did it itself. They sold you that for 99 cents and then threw in the disc for free, because that made sense to people, that it was flying on an invisible string. And, wow. and now we're kind of inured to that, you know, because we're used to it. But to the untrained eye, it's a way big, amazing thing. And that's the heart of the magic, really.
It is. It really is.
Jennifer, I'm now up to three incredible business ideas.
You're going to do a
Stork,
string?
We have this weird thing that keeps happening here on our podcast, and that is our guests bring up interesting topics, and all of a sudden, Jennifer and I have this light bulb idea that will make us instant millionaires. And so far in this conversation, we've already had several ideas. One is a simple PDGA hacky sack. I think that would sell. And then second would be some kind of an actual motorized disc. Not sure how that would work, but surely with drone technology, we can apply it. Right. And then third is this invisible string. I mean, people once bought pet rocks, so surely disc golfers will buy a prepackaged invisible string. So there, Jennifer, we're millionaires several times over.
Maybe if we hit the Titanic iceberg, maybe some of those ideas, but I think right now just selling frisbees is working fine.
Have you really come to grips with how appealing attaching food to email would be?
Oh no, I forgot that one. You're right. That would be number four. Yes.
You passed on that.
Digital food. No, I didn't pass on it. It was just so far. It was so high above me. My brain didn't wrap around that one. You're right. That would be a fourth. And I have a feeling that one, if you could pull it off, might be the most lucrative.
Oh, absolutely.
Email your pizza to yourself.
So Dan, as all these numbers continue to grow and grow, at what point did we need to stop and say, okay, we need to teach people the love of the game? And how did you come about the disc golfers code?
That was a very nicely nuanced question.
Well, real quick, Dan, let me stop you and just make sure that everyone listening right now realizes, just at the end of this past week, we dropped a story at pdga.com about the disc golfers code. Mm. Simply put, because we figure there are so many new to the sport, so many new PDGA members and others that may not even be members, but that are now paying attention and even beginning to play, much like I did. That's why my PDGA number is higher than you would think. I played for literally a decade, and it wasn't until near the end of that decade when I even found out there was a PDGA.
Yeah.
But at any rate, we wanted to introduce the disc golfers code. So that's one of the reasons we wanted to talk to you about it today.
When I said that it was a nicely nuanced question, it really does have to do with this growth rate, in that we spoke earlier about back in the day, when this came out and that came into your mailbox, essentially Frisbee World.
Yeah, you're holding a magazine up that says Frisbee World on it.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm sorry. For you, those of you
who, for radio listeners,
for those of you who have not bought the premium version, yes, I'm holding up a magazine. And if you're under 25, this is something that used to come. It was paper, very thinly cut wood that people printed things on, and they were delivered to your home. Anyway, this magazine, I don't think I'm exaggerating to say every serious Frisbee player on the globe read every word. Mm-hmm. And so when I wrote something here that said, hey, folks, we're going to change gears here, or we've got to pay more attention to this, or here's a new game, Discathon. You may hate it or love it, but here's what we're going to do this year, NAS. This reached every potential player.
Right.
Everyone, either first or second. With this growth phase, which I think we all can agree is impossibly steep, mm-hmm. this growth, we've moved from knowing every player, and even as it moved on, let me say, even if it's got later, when it got to, let's say, 78, 79, I would see somebody play in San Francisco, Golden Gate Park, and I'd say, hey, are you from New York State, from Rochester? They go, yeah, how do you know? Oh, because that's a Jeff Hungerford move.
Oh, wow.
Oh, okay. You know, because like accents were so still pure that, oh yeah, Jeff's my buddy. He and I went to school together. We had Jim Palmieri for our physics professor. Okay, great. That's the connection. Now, it's so big that the old screens that used to be in place where you had to find the sport, it was kind of hard to find. You had to know somebody, or you had to have, you know, you found Stansel Johnson's book, and then, oh, man, that sounds cool. I wonder how do we figure this out? We invented our own course. We laid it out, whatever. You had to go through a lot of things. Now, if you've got access to the internet, you've got access to all this information, and we'll go out. And I mean, I'm my term for people who don't know the magic is muggles. A muggle is someone who knows nothing of the magic. So, muggles on the left, you know, don't throw, because, you know, muggle pushing a muggle cart, you know, a little muggle in the cart, you know, so wait, and then we'll play. So the other day, I'm watching this kid tee off at, Whittier Narrows, and he's trying to work. He's a righty. He's trying to work a delicate roll curve approach in with some typically overstable disc. And I'm saying, I don't want to interfere, but have you considered a forehand for this? Just let the disc do the work. I mean, throw it out there flat, let it dive in. It's almost cheating. And he says, well, if I had a sidearm like Nate Sexton, I guess I would. I mean, I'm going, what? I mean, this just stumbling around kid is telling me about Nate Sexton's sidearm.
It's pretty good.
You know, and it's amazing. And do I have a disc here? Oh, this is embarrassing. Oh, well, we'll use an ultimate disc. I see a kid on the tee, and he's like, he's flapping the disc in his hand. And I'm saying, excuse me, I don't want to interrupt, but obviously I interrupt a lot. I said, how long have you been doing that? He said, what? He said, like waving the disc like this before you throw. Says, oh, I don't know, a while. I said, do you watch streaming or Jomez or anything? Do you watch the pros? Oh, yeah, I watch them all the time. I said, well, that's where you got it. I mean, that does KJUSA mean anything to you? I mean, that's where you picked that up. And so the very interesting thing is that now we're almost back to where there's enough eyeballs seeing things that we can, in fact, have mass impact. If they do something on the Pro Tour, for good or bad, mm-hmm. Hoi Polloi knows it the next day. And so one of the reasons that, and I've got to give Justin Menichelli credit for this, because he really was the inspiration, because he's a skier. Mm-hmm. And there's a skier's code that uses this, which is a similar thing, because people are out on the ski hill. I don't know if you guys are skiers, but mm-hmm. it's a inherently risky activity, and people have to be civil mm-hmm. in order for it to last, because if they aren't, they're going to kill each other out there. I mean, they're going to ski fast and run over. And there is a similar code for skiers that all skiers know, recreational skiers. And Justin said, when, I guess it was maybe, God, can it be 8 years ago by now?
Fall of 2015, I think.
15?
Fall of 2015 is what I found when that fall summit of the PDGA board.
Impossible. No. That's too long. Are you finding there's like a mental gap that this last couple of years? I mean, it's yes. like the good news that I found out is I saw on some website that those 2 years are not going to be deducted from your expected life.
I know. I wish they would be, because I woke up like, this morning and I thought it was a Tuesday in 2019 again.
Yeah. It's like fishing, you know, those mm-hmm. hours are not deducted anyway. And I headed up the beginning of the thinking on sustainability of the sport for the board. And there were three columns to the discussion. And the three columns were player education, course and event design, mm-hmm. And technology. Those were the three components that all work together on sustainability. And player awareness is the number one most important and most effective one, because that awareness trumps everything else. That is, if someone makes a choice, wise or unwise choice, it doesn't matter about all those other components, because they're in control of that moment. And so this was an attempt, the code was an attempt to codify, to really simplify it, to codify civility and empathy. Mainly empathy of trying to relate to, we're sharing this space. Mm-hmm. And it's a sidebar on, we'd love to transition to more situations where it's all our space, but we're in the realistic world is that we share the space. And so we have to be empathetic. We also have to realize that every activity has some risk. What we do has some risk. I mean, nobody wants to get hit by a baseball, a golf ball, a javelin, a shot put, any of those things. And you don't want to be hit by a disc. And so we, every one of us, not just the pros, but that group of people walking out there Tuesday morning, they have to realize that they have an obligation. If they want the game to continue, mm-hmm. they have an obligation to realize that there's a burden on them. And part of the reason that I think that it's been hard for people to grasp is because we developed from in the early going, the discs we were throwing were so benign,
right,
that they were a non-issue. I mean, if a Pluto platter came flying into your picnic, it's just a nothing.
Yep.
And we kind of trained ourselves or kidded ourselves into thinking that it was still nothing. And we know now it isn't. I like the mentality of thinking, I don't know if you ever went to summer camp and did archery, mm-hmm. but the nature of the guy or gal who ran archery was, you don't step over that line until all the arrows are out.
Right.
I don't care if it's down there, but she couldn't possibly, hey, you don't step over this line until all the arrows are out. And I hope that with things like this, people, when they step to the tee, will realize they have a very heavy responsibility. And if it's that I could possibly interfere with somebody else down there, I don't throw.
Right.
I don't throw this. Well, there's a blind path coming out in the left, and there's hardly anybody ever on it. Hardly anybody ever on it. That's, you need a spotter.
Yeah.
If there's ever anybody on it, we can't throw this throw unless we're guaranteeing ourselves there's nobody there. And so all of those things take some level of responsibility. And I realize that we all are adolescent in some of the things we do, but this was an attempt to codify the basic things that we hope everyone will bear in mind every time they throw the disc. And it's the most essential thing to our success, in my mind.
And by early 2016, they had settled, this group of board members and staff had settled on three simple points. Forget a rule book that, while our rule book is not exactly unwieldy, it's actually fairly brief, but forget a rule book that would be impossible to memorize. Just three points make up the disc golfer's code: play smart, respect the course, and represent the sport. Why those three?
Well, because I think we wanted it short enough. One has to be aware of the appetite for remembering. Mm-hmm. Do you know how high crows can count by any chance?
Surprisingly enough, no. Jennifer, you?
I'm going to just throw out one. let's keep it simple. Let's just keep it simple.
So, wait a minute. How many fingers do crows have?
If those are fingers, I think it's three. That is so species. That's one. Oh, goodness sakes. Okay. Crows can count to seven. Okay. If you send seven hunters into the woods and the crows are sitting up there waiting to go in, and only six come out, they don't go in. They know there's another guy in there. They're saying, wait, there's one left. You send eight hunters in and seven come out and they go, oh, we're good to go. We're good to go. They're overwhelmed. Well, our assessment was that our typical reader, it was three points. Four, and you're going, oh, I don't know, there were so many, I can't tell you.
Yeah.
Three you can remember and hopefully take to heart. And incidentally, I'm not saying this is for only on the course. Mm-hmm. You should have this stuck up in your car as well. I mean, I think we can agree that there's a certain level of civility that seems to be eroded in much of our life. And so these are pretty good guidelines in the mall.
No doubt about it. If everybody would follow these guidelines in the mall, or at least in the mall parking lot, I think the world would be a much more peaceful place. No doubt about it. Well, as we attempt to land this plane, which has already been on one of the more incredible journeys that I have been on during the short but significant lifespan of this podcast, at least since Jennifer and I took it over, what are your sort of closing thoughts on, you know, the state of disc golf now? We've talked about the early days. We got right up to about the time that Jennifer and I started playing. We've talked about the era around 2015, 2016, when the disc golfer's code was actually committed to paper and now is committed to stickers and needs to be committed to so much more than that. Here we are, 2021, with a membership. We gave out the membership number 201,000 and change. I can't remember the last part of the number. As of December 31st of last year. So now we're however far beyond that. What are your thoughts about the state of the game now? What surprises you? What doesn't surprise you? And where do you think we're headed here in the next couple of years?
Wow. I'll tell you what what surprises me is that I knew it was a great game. I mean, I wrote, I think back in, one thing about being a journalist, as you know, Grant, is that it lives on for good or bad long after you.
Indeed.
That is, it's easy enough to reinvent what you think you said back, you know, in 1987. But when it's in print, I mean, and I think pretty early in the going, I said, this is one of the most telegenic games that there is, because there are so many wonderful decisions that have to be made. And the personality of the player making those decisions is going to be so available to the coverage. I mean, when Phil Mickelson hits a kind of a draw into the green, you can't tell what he's doing. I mean, it's kind of up there and you end up, you see the end result. But when Jennifer stands there and there's three different clear choices, she can try to skip it. She can throw a forehand that's high and diving in, or she can throw a spike hyzer. All of those are super clear to the viewer. And it's a chance for her to show her personality, her grit, her perseverance, her terror at this situation that viewers are going to relate to. So I wrote that pretty far back. So then I'm sitting in the board, and Maple Hill, Steve, help me.
Steve
here.
Dodge or Steve Hill? Dodge.
I know it as well as my son's name.
Yeah, Steve Dodge.
I say that, and my wife says, no, that's not true. You don't know that guy's name as well as you know Tyler's name. I said, yes, I know Steve Dodge's name as well as my own. Steve is sitting next to me, his first board meeting. And he says he's pushing harder than early board members typically do. You know, usually you kind of tread water a little bit, kind of get a feel for it. Not Steve. Steve's in there. He's got a big proposal first day out. You know, it's 2 inches thick. And I'm beside him going, hey, Steve, you know, kind of slow it down a little bit. You know, you don't want to be. Have you ever watched Survivor? Those guys get voted out right away. Okay. So be careful. So Steve says, it's all about live stream play. We're going to push hard. I want to see a big investment in live stream play. People want to see live stream play. And I'm going, you know, Steve, I said, here's the thing about disc golf. I've been around a long time. People don't want to watch disc golf. They want to play disc golf. Okay. Man, was I wrong. I was so wrong. I mean, right now, when it's on, I have it on. I'm not sitting just glued to it, but it's rolling all the time. I'm pulling weeds at Jennifer's putting. You know, I'm painting the sidewall. You know, Paige is stepping up. Is she going to catch Cat? You know, I mean, I'm monitoring it every minute. I mean, I assume Jeff Spring has me listed as the number one biggest number of minutes viewer that there is. So
if he doesn't, I will make sure he is aware.
Thank you. Thank you. I mean, I was so wrong. And Steve, if you're out there, it's Dodge, right? Steve, if you're out there, I'm sorry for that thing I said. You were right. And your course looks pretty sweet too. I'd like to get up there. But anyway, that's amazing to me. Here's the second amazing thing. Mark and Susie Horn and I are all longtime buddies from way, way, way back, you know, before you guys were born. And we've been playing golf, and we have a pretty big circle of friends who we walk with, we play poker with, we play pickleball with, we have book clubs with, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. For all those years, they knew we played disc golf. Meh, you know, whatever. Interesting thing. About 8 months ago, inexplicably, they said, you know, some of us would like to learn to play disc golf. We're going, huh, what? What? I mean, really? Okay, well, fine. We ought to start off. You don't want to go to the Grove first. There's a lot of trees. let's go to the field. We'll go to Hamilton and throw a little and see if you actually like it. Or, you know, we want you to have a good first experience. You know, six of them show up. Okay. Fair enough. In that 6 months, they have now moved to, they all have PDGA memberships.
Aww.
They all have UDisc memberships. They all have Disc Golf Pro Tour streaming TV rights and know pretty much all the players, have their favorites. They have bought portable baskets. They have, they're on the edge of carts. They all have bags. Tracy, my one student, shows up the other day and he goes, how far do you think that is, Stork? And I said, oh, I don't know. I mean, it's probably, I'd say, you know, go with your mid. And he says, well, let me check. And pulls out his range finder. I'm going, oh my God, unbelievable. Tracy has a range finder.
It helps so much.
it's incredible. And so I open my email expecting to see him sending something about the next poker game. And he says, Stork, I've decided that I'm going to run a putting event at my house on the 20th, you know, and I want help with the number of events and how many people can bring baskets. And I'm every Saturday morning is putting league, which used to be just sit around and talk about walking or something. Now everybody's out playing horse. And I have come to the conclusion that I often use the drug dealer model. And that is, you know, I mean, meth is a fantastic product in that once people are using it, it's very hard to stop, apparently. I used to tell my students, don't try it. It's great. That's the problem, you know? So, I think, I mean, our growth numbers are continuing, and that's the reason that it's not going to be just a fad thing that people are out playing and now they're going to move on to something else. I mean, I go to the Grove now and it's like one of the most vibrant social clubs I know. There's so many people coming that you don't have to make arrangements to play with somebody. You just come and you hang out and then you leave with some group and people are hanging and talking about this and there's a little putting thing going on over here. And I mean, and this is without a pro shop there.
Mm.
I mean, it's just such a vibrant experience that I mean, it's fulfilling my personal goals because here's the irony of my experience with these sports. I am a arch competitor. I love competition, whether it's paper tossing, because I am a very good paper
player.
Google it. I love that. I'm an arch competitor, but it's those other experiences of it that I am really about. I just became aware that a lot of people in disc golf, apparently they count the throws. That's a big deal. I thought the rating was how much fun you were having. And I'm going, hey, I'm having more fun than that. I can't believe that. I had lots of fun. I should be a higher rating. I wrote in a recent article, for me, it's all about being able to produce the flight that I imagine. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I am excited and thrilled every time I step up to throw. And you just can't say that about too many other things in life. I mean, I'm about to be 74 or something, and I'm more fired up about it now than I've been in my whole life. And bless my wife, Janet. I mean, I came home today and I said, okay, I've just found 10 more feet on my drive.
Mm.
I've got a brand new thing. I just looked at a video. It was the last thing I looked at it the other night. The free hand that has just been flying around, I'm crossing it over now in the power pocket. And boom, I mean, when I threw that, there was a snap I've never felt before. And she says, Wow, that's great to hear, honey. That's great.
She sounds like my wife.
Well, let me know if that's still going on at 74.
Oh, boy, I hope so.
I had the wonderful privilege of speaking to four amazing men at Masters Worlds this year that were trying to get just those few more feet so they could beat Pete May. Bobby Fischer being one of them. We become pretty good friends now, but it was so cute because they played so much longer than me. And they were asking me, how can we get just like 10 more feet?
Wow.
So it's wonderful. I mean, once you see and create, like you said, create and watch that Frisbee fly, it's you're hooked for sure.
Well, when you take on the task of beating Pete May, you need more than 10 feet. I mean, do you realize that Pete is the national table tennis champion for his age group?
Yes.
And tennis. And disc golf, and he's interested in pickleball. And I wouldn't put it past him. So good luck to those guys, because if they get better, I can tell you this, Pete will get better.
That's true.
He's something.
Well, Stork, we've taken up an hour of your time here on a Friday afternoon as we record this episode. And it feels like if we stop at any moment, we're basically cutting the conversation short. it just doesn't feel like there's a great way to land this plane. Maybe we should just leave the plane aloft and come back to it. They can fuel planes in midair nowadays. Maybe we should just leave it aloft and come back to it. Maybe at some point in the future, we've got so much going on this year with we haven't even gotten to Champions Cup and all of the world championships and all of those kinds of things. Those are still, at least a month out.
Months away.
And yeah. I know we're going to have the pleasure, both Jennifer and I, of crossing paths with you here before too long, as I got to for the first time ever back at last year's Fall Summit, not even knowing that that was the exact environment when you were so instrumental in creating the Disc Golfers Code. Didn't realize what kind of history I was sort of getting to see with my own eyes while just sitting around in a room with people like you. So, I can't think of a question or a statement to leave you with other than just our great thanks for you spending some time with us today.
Hey, I'm really flattered and pleased that you asked me to come on, and you're doing such a great job with this. I mean, it's part of spreading the word, and it's so entertaining, and you guys do a great job with it. I'm just really pleased to have been asked. I mean, I'm just an old man sitting around here with memories.
That's still working on his game.
That's true. Well, I will tell you a thing I used to say in some of the demos. I'd say, kid would come up and say, what's the hardest trick? What's the hardest trick? And I'd say, the hardest trick is to put it down.
Oh. And that's the bumper sticker.
Which is where we are.
That's the bumper sticker and the t-shirt. And that's where, that's going to go down. That we're going to write that down and probably find a way to use that statement, because that is perfectly said, Stork. Thank you so much again for spending this time. Like they say in the world of media and the world of marketing in general, leave the audience wanting more. So I think that's exactly what we'll do right now, and we'll come back for more hopefully sometime later this calendar year. Once again, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.